You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Listen, Saturday, September 24th, I'm holding my Get Your Show Off the Ground workshop. I'm not doing as many of these as I used to, so reserve your spot now. Half of them are already gone. Saturday, September 24th, go to the blog, theproducersperspective.com, to reserve your spot today. Now on with the podcast.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the end of summer episode of The Producer's Perspective. My name is Ken Davenport. I'm so excited to have on the podcast one of the real journeyman Broadway producers, six-time Tony Award-winning producer, Mr. Richard Frankel. Welcome, Richard.
Hello. Nice to be here.
So Richard has produced a wide variety of projects on Broadway and off Broadway. I have a special place in my heart for people that do both. From The Producers to Hairspray to Smokey Joe's Cafe, not to mention Penn and Teller, on and off, and the show that keeps on stomping, Stomp. So, Richard, tell us, how'd you end up in the theater biz? Where did it all begin?
The head of the stage crew in my high school was this gorgeous woman who turned out to be a really inspirational theater teacher as well. So I ended up with two, actually, inspirational theater teachers in high school. And they both were gorgeous, and they both were wonderful, and I just got completely hooked in high school on the stage crew, being like the AV squad, that kind of thing, you know, doing lights and sound and building sets and such.
And how did that lead to producing? How did that, you follow these women wherever they went?
Well, I followed them through high school, and then I in college, I majored in theater. And I started working as soon as I got out. I always knew I wanted to do this. I first wanted to be a stage manager. After a time as a stage manager and many, many other jobs, there's a line from a Lanford Wilson play that I quote frequently, which is, it's in, I think, A Tale Told, where there's a tennis player, a pro tennis player, and he was a young kid with no money. And somebody handed him a tennis racket, and he hit the ball with the tennis racket. As soon as the ball hit the racket, he knew he was a tennis player. And so the line is, once you know what you are, the rest is just work. And that's really how it's been for me. I was very lucky where I knew that this is what I wanted to do from an early age.
And when you were in college majoring in theater, were you an acting major, a tech major?
I was, I basically did tech. I actually ended up majoring in television production at Brooklyn College. But I did a lot of plays, and took a lot of theater courses. I actually majored in television production because I liked the people in the television department better than I liked the people in the theater department. I've said, actually, that even after all these years, after 40 years and working with great stars and who I adore, I still haven't encountered arrogance like college seniors in the theater department. That's sort of the epitome that I've encountered in my entire life of arrogance. I like the people in the television department, so I did a lot of work in there too.
And your first job out of school?
My first job out of school was right out of school. I went into the Peace Corps for 2 years, and I lived in Ethiopia for 2 years, which was great for somebody from Brooklyn. I was 20 years old when I got out of college, and I had really not been out of Brooklyn before. Well, I think I'd been to Miami once or twice, which was like Brooklyn, you know, so. But I had 2 years in a village in Ethiopia. When I came back, I jumped right in. Actually, I got a job as a, quote, sound technician on a show where they, on an off-Broadway show, where, you know, they told me which dial to turn at which time, and I pressed the play on the record. I didn't, couldn't fix anything or do anything. But I started doing that, and then I was an assistant stage manager, and I did a lot of tech jobs, and I used to build sets at the Delacorte in the summers. I worked as a kind of unskilled stagehand doing set construction all night. We used to, I don't know if they still do it, but the show would close on Sunday, and the other one would open on Wednesday or Thursday. And people would work 24 hours in the park getting the sets in, which was better than thrilling. And I had a wide variety of jobs like that. I believe I once worked for the Weislers when they were doing Shakespeare out of a station wagon. And I like loaded the station wagon once, you know, for whatever it was per hour. But I had a wide variety of tech jobs. Eventually, I became a stage manager and got into the union. And then at some point, I decided that I didn't want to work 8 shows a week. I didn't mind working hard as producers or marketing directors as I became work, but I didn't want the 8 show a week life. You know, that's a particular choice that people make. And it's a, well, they don't view it as a sacrifice, I don't think, because, you know, most are thrilled every time they, you know, walking through the stage door makes up for it. But I didn't want to. So I got into management.
So you started in general management, and company management is what you did
First, so I was off Broadway for a long time. I worked at La Mama for several years. I went to Europe with the La Mama company, and I worked downtown. I used to say that there was probably a couple of years that I didn't go above 14th Street. And then I got a job at Ensemble Studio Theater as the sort of all-purpose administrative person. I did everything, from fundraising to marketing to brochures to, you know, press to all sorts of stuff. And then I went to a regional theater as a marketing director and press agent. And then I went to Circle Rep, which was the sort of the seminal influence on my life. I was there in the late 70s and early 80s when it was really a fantastical place. We were doing, 5th of July and Tally's Folly and all the Lanford Wilson plays and Buried Child and Mamet and Sam Shepard. It was really thrilling being there. I was the marketing director for a few years, and then I became the managing director. And as the managing director, we moved several shows to Off-Broadway and ran them, like Fool for Love. We ran for a few years, actually, and we moved Tally's Folly to Broadway and various other things. So when I left there, I thought I had sufficient experience in running shows, you know, off Broadway, and even knew a little about on Broadway. I hardly knew anything, I realize in retrospect, but I thought it was good training.
And the first show you produced?
Penn and Teller. While I was at Circle, I had gotten the rights to Penn and Teller, who were just magicians. And they had wanted to move from being magicians, and they were making a living doing magic castles and various magician gigs, but they wanted more. They wanted the theater. And I talked them into giving me the rights to produce them in New York.
Do you remember what you paid for those rights?
I don't remember what I paid for the rights, but I remember that the show cost $175,000 to do at the West Side Art, and that I was going to take, it was my first job. It was my first commercial job, not getting a salary. And I had a child and, you know, I had to make a living. And so it was important that this succeed for me. And it was very important for them too. This was their shot at New York. So there was a sense of urgency. I wouldn't say desperation, but there was real urgency, and we really depended on each other to do a good job. They were depending on me, and I was certainly depending on them. And I'll say this, because it was them mostly, opposed to me. You know, we nailed it. It just was great. It was a fantastic period of time, and it was a fantastic success. And they were on Saturday Night Live, for this was 85, they were on Saturday Night Live the season of, I think, 86, 87, like 7 times, and they were on Letterman multiple times, and they were just kind of a cultural sensation, as they well deserved. And in raising the money for Penn and Teller, of which I was going to take 6 months and a couple of $1,000 here and a couple of $1,000 there to do it, because I didn't have really sufficient contacts, I met Tom Vertel and Steve Baruch, who were in the real estate business looking to get into the theater. So we quickly saw that there was a symbiotic relationship to be had. I, as I say, thought I was long on experience. I wasn't quite as long as I thought, but I thought I knew what I was doing, and they had access to investors. The real estate business was really booming at that time. And so they would raise the money, and I would show them what I know, and we would split everything. And we've been doing that since 1985. We've been together and doing all the shows. Steve Baruch, who still handles our fundraising, raised the money for Penn & Teller in an afternoon. He called up, 10 or 12 people who put up $10,000 or $15,000 each, and it was done. You know, I was literally, it was, I think we started in October, and I was, planning on it taking 6 months, that I'd have the money by spring, and he did it in an afternoon. Very impressive. And it turned out to be a wonderful relationship with Penn & Teller and a wonderful show. And our relationship with them has continued, even though, we're far apart geographically. They've been in Las Vegas for, 18 years, whatever it is. But we brought them back to Broadway last year. But it was great. It was a really satisfying experience.
So think back to that moment where you decided you were going to get the rights to Penn & Teller and produce their show. Look, my first show I produced, it was just me in my apartment. I wasn't married. I wasn't even dating anybody. Here, you have a family. You have a child. You're going to produce your first show. What gave you the courage to think, I can do this? I can make this happen. I can make this work.
I had been, they say it takes 10 years. I had been working in the theater since, 70, 71. I thought this was the time. I thought this was the time. When I left Circle, I could have, gone to another regional theater. I remember talking to a couple, but it just seemed like this was the moment.
It's funny. It's the same thing for me. I was company managing shows for 10 years, and then a show came along, and I was like, I think it's just time. I better just give this a shot. I did not raise all my money in one afternoon, however.
No, nor could I have. I tell, like, our interns now, I tell people that, the one thing you can hire a general, if you want to be a producer, you can hire a general manager to do almost everything except raise the money. Getting the property and raising the money, the two things you can't avoid. And someone who wants to be a producer who figures, well, I have a lot of skill and I was a stage manager and I know how the theater works and I can do this. I just have this little problem with fundraising. You can't avoid it. I know you know this. I guess I'm saying this for your audience, but I do make a point of it to the interns. And the time-tested way of dealing with that is, if you don't have a lot of money or access to money, find somebody who does and become their partner. And that's sort of the time-honored way of dealing with this problem, but it has to be faced and has to be dealt with.
Fantastic advice. And still to this day, you all are one of the few producers out there like me that you like the small investor, right?
Yes.
You embrace the small investor. Why do you like the small guy versus the big whales?
Well, the first, it happened by accident. It was a great idea that we fell into. I mean, we had, I think, 12 people for Penn & Teller, and the second show we did was Driving Miss Daisy, which was costing $400,000 to transfer from Playwrights Horizons to Off-Broadway. And we had half of it. Jane Harmon had the other half. And so we had to raise $200,000 for that. And we thought we should include, we had to ask the Penn & Teller people if they wanted to continue and do the second show. And then we wanted some new people to come in. So we realized that we would restrict it to $10,000. And we told people they could not invest more than $10,000. And we got our 20 people and we did Driving Miss Daisy. And of course, that was a big success too. And we did national tours of it, and we learned a bit about, you know, doing bigger productions at the same time. And so the $10,000 was just something we started doing, and then we continued it with the subsequent shows. What it did, and why we still like it, is that it turns theater, quote, investing, close quote, into recreation. It's just not the same thing. If you're putting $10,000 in a show and you get half of it back, so you've got five of it back and you get a tax deduction for the other $5,000, and you went to the opening night and you got a poster and you had a good time with it, it puts theatrical investing, we believe, where it actually belongs, which is in entertainment, in recreation. And it takes the pressure. The kid's not going to go to college because they lost their money on a play. And they're not going to be unable to pay the mortgage. And honestly, that's it. And so there are some people who have continued with us through all the shows, 70, 80, shows since, but we have a few left from Penn and Teller. But people do it, and some have done very, very well, and some have lost the money, but it's never the financial catastrophe that would make you think better about buying a bond, for example, if you're actually investing.
One of the other things I've loved is I've watched your company from afar, and now from a close, if you will, because your office is just close to ours in the same building, is that over the years, you do a lot of things in-house. You general manage in-house, you've had accounting in-house, you have marketing in-house. Talk to me about the benefits of doing everything in-house instead of going to many of the vendors.
Well, we loved it, especially when we were doing a huge volume, which we were for a long time, for many years, when we were doing Producers and Hairspray and the first round of Smokey Joe's Cafe and such. We had multiple companies of several shows, so the office might have two tours of the Producers plus Producers in New York and Hairspray in New York and two tours of that and a London company and everything else. So there might be 8 or 10 or 12 productions, full-size Broadway productions, being operated out of the office. And Stomp has continued since 94. So we always had Stomp, and we had two tours of Stomp for a while. So when we had this mass volume, it just seemed efficient to have a lot of the functions in-house. The other thing, which we, half joked about, was that you could, there are services like tour booking, which we did in-house for a long time, or press, which we did in-house, we no longer, but our volume isn't like that anymore. But you can, you can stand over somebody's shoulder and yell at them. Not that we yell at people, but you really can keep a close eye on it, because it's everybody in the theater who is, all the independent vendors, including ourselves as general managers, everybody's juggling multiple shows. And there's a certain comfort to know that your marketing director is doing nobody's marketing but you. And that's not that all the independent vendors in the theater, including ourselves as general managers, don't do wonderful jobs for every client, but there's a certain comfort in it.
How have you had a checklist for picking shows that you want to produce over the years, or how do you make a choice?
That's like the great question, right? Well, for one thing, your choice is amongst what's available. That's first choice. The Book of Mormon was not available to us. I would like to think that had the Book of Mormon come through the transom, we would have said, hey, this is really great. The Producers was available to us. So the first thing is that a lot of the shows that you would love to have done just ain't yours, and you can't, and you don't have any access to them. How you choose a show, of course, is the $64 million question. And, I think the first thing to me is how engaging emotionally it is for the audience. If you can move them, they will come. They will buy tickets. They will tell their friends, but they have to be emotionally engaged. They have to be really drawn into it. They have to care. And it has to be a subject they care about, whether or not they knew in the first instance that they cared about it. I don't know that, Hairspray, for example, which has all of the political points about issues about inclusion and such. I don't know if somebody set out to make a musical about inclusion, whether you would, you know, but it ended up being about a girl wanting to dance on TV. And in the getting there, you have a lot of realizations and a lot of truths are revealed about the way you feel about race and the way you feel about opportunity and inclusion. And it's just an altogether fascinating subject as well as being emotionally engaging. So I would say the first thing is it emotionally engaging? And the second thing, is it a subject that people want to see? Is it, whether or not they know it, is it a subject that will interest them? Unfortunately, there's a lot of musicals, especially that we see, that are written about subjects that, you know, I just wish that the composer and the book writer had, you know, kind of run it past us first. Like, should I, you know, I got this great idea for a musical. Well, at that point, you should really be examining what the subject is and whether it's, you know, whether you're surfing the zeitgeist and whether it's something that people really care about and people can really get engaged in. And the battle's, you know, half won or lost there.
Anything you remember passing on that you wish you wouldn't have passed on?
Damn. I'm sure there are. And my partners will no doubt remind me of things that I didn't want to do that, but I can't think of anything at the moment. I did have, I remember having the thought when I worked off Broadway in the 80s that I took comfort in the fact that every good show that you saw in the 80s, anywhere other than the Shakespeare Festival and the Public Theater, Joe Papp had passed on. Because he got everything first. Everybody went to him first. So I thought, well, he can't be that smart. I mean, because everything good on Broadway, everything good off Broadway, he decided not to do, is the way I used to think about it. So I can't think specifically of something that we passed on, actually.
You've been producing for a couple of decades now.
Yes.
How is it, what's the one, the biggest difference you see about producing today versus producing on Broadway when you started?
Well, I mean, I wish I could say that. I mean, I was unfortunately, I guess, fortunately or unfortunately, even though I started in the 80s, the day when one guy produced a musical, Herman Shumlin, had passed. So that wasn't in the cards even when I started, and it required partnerships. It didn't require partnerships on the scale that we have now. And although the sums were, you know, really high, they didn't require the kind of crazy, desperate scrambling for large, gigantic amounts of money that it does now. So that's different. I think if we're talking about all producing, that is plays and as well as musicals, the biggest difference, I guess, was that when we started, fortunately, plays were done off Broadway and commercial. You could have real commercial successes with plays off Broadway, which is much more difficult now. Now, and plays, as I recall, weren't being done that frequently on Broadway. Now, of course, you can do any play you want on Broadway as long as you have a movie star. And so we have a couple of plays that we're trying to produce on Broadway, and it's focused at the moment on a search for movie stars, which seems to be what's required. Back when I started, I was doing Driving Miss Daisy and Frankie and Johnny and The Clair de Lune and The Cocktail Hour and all these plays that made money, Love Letters, the first production. I mean, they made money. They were good plays. It was like a piece of business. It was sort of buy cheap and sell dear. You would do the play. It would have its run. It would run a year or two, and you could get a tour out of it. And it was very simple. Off Broadway now is much more challenging, just because the number of seats and the expenses, you know, haven't stayed in sync. So Broadway plays, you know, require movie stars, and Broadway musicals. Require vast amounts of money, of course. But then I don't know if I'm jumping ahead. But then there's the theater jam up, which in my mind is all to do with variable pricing.
Expand on this one. This is new. I haven't heard this. I love this idea.
Well, now it's very scientific. I hope I'm not telling tales out of school. It's very scientific about how prices are set. And these premium prices don't come out of the sky. They're figured out. And if somebody bought H101 and 103 for a particular price, they look at what they can, what we look at what we can sell H105 and 107 for the following week. And the result is that shows, I think, are doing better financially than they used to. Used to be that a, you know, play would kind of have run its course and the grosses would decline. I mean, it still happens, of course. But I just think this, the process has stretched out much longer now because ticket yield is an actual factor in the economics of a show. So that, combined with the short runs for the movie stars, which can happen in the playhouses, there's just no theaters. I mean, it's just become a sort of nightmarish.
Well, let's talk about premium ticketing for a bit, sure. Because you were a producer on The Producer,
yes.
One of the biggest hits of the last 20 years,
yes,
that we've had. And you were really one of the first shows to do a real premium ticket with the,
right,
now defunct, what, Broadway Inner Circle.
Yes.
Which had the top price for The Producers was
$400. Seems quaint and cute now.
I know. And I was Googling about this, and you guys got a lot of flack for this.
We did. We got a lot of flack for, we were on, when we opened and we had the face value of the ticket $100 as opposed to, it had been 89 or 90 for other shows, we were on page one of the New York Times, not the inside front, you know, the first page of the entertainment section. It was on page one of the New York Times that we had charged $100 for a ticket, which of course now is a bargain. I mean, The Producers, you know, was heaven on earth in every respect. I mean, creatively, it was creatively, financially, in every way, it was just a wonderful experience, really a privilege. And when we opened and the lines were literally around the block, we felt big and bad for a period of time. And then we realized that many, most, some large proportion of the tickets were simply being bought by brokers who were reselling them. So we were selling them for $100 and feeling terrific, and they were selling them for God knows what. And that money was not going to Mel and the other authors and Tom Meehan, and it wasn't going to the director and the designers who had royalties, and it wasn't going to our investors, and it wasn't going to us. It was going to guys who had addresses in New Jersey and 300 credit cards who were buying up the tickets and reselling them. So it was disturbing. And I know it was perceived as rampaging greed, but it honestly was, we didn't see it that way. We honestly thought it was unfair, and we were going to try and get the system righted the best we could so that the money went where it should be going, which is to the people who created the show and the investors who invested the $10.5 million in the show, because none of them were participating in the resale market. So we, you know, figured this out and tried to do it. And of course, in retrospect, it was very primitive what we were doing, and it didn't really last. The Producers did just fine. We're not complaining about how we did on The Producers. But it was a beginning infantile effort at this, and we took the heat for everybody else who is now doing really well from it. So there we are.
You were like one of the first barricades thrown in the street that didn't cause the French Revolution, but you started it.
Well, that's exactly right. Or, I don't know, you know, Battle of Algiers, about the Algerian Revolution. It all takes place 4 years before the actual revolution happened, and they all get killed just like, you know, it's just like they miss everybody. You get shot down in the street, and the real revolution happens a few years later. That's sort of what happened with us, although it's ridiculous for me to say that we were shot down in the street with The Producers. It was great, and it was a wonderful experience. But that was our tale about the premium seats.
When did you know on The Producers that you had something special that was really gonna knock it out of the park like it did? Was it,
well,
in the rehearsal room? Was it when,
well,
when you read?
So that's actually a story. So, you know, the fact is that Mel and Tom Meehan wrote The Producers, and they developed it with Mike Ockrent, who was married to Susan Stroman, and they developed it themselves. And then they did a reading, and they invited all the producers in town to come to the reading. But they did it, they cast it, they wrote the whole thing. So every producer in town went to this reading, and it was fantastic. And it was born perfect. I mean, I would like to say that as the producer of the producers, I created it, was solely responsible for its quality. But the fact is they created it, the five people and Ben Kelly and various other people, five, six people, created the piece. And it came out of the womb sort of perfect. Very minor changes between that reading and what we ended up with on stage. Only much of the cast was in the reading as well. So everyone, most people, I think, completely flipped at the reading. I certainly did. And I didn't know Mel, and I didn't know anybody else. And he was surrounded by people who knew him, other producers, theater owners. And I talked to him, but he was looking over my shoulder at somebody else more important. So I went home despondent, and I wrote him a letter. And I wrote him a letter that explained how it had been, you know, I remember seeing the movie of the producers in the Cinémathèque in Paris in the early 70s, where I was the only one laughing. In the theater, nobody else found it funny. And I was rolling on the floor, and I had watched it a million times afterwards, and my kids watched it, and it was a family thing, and we absolutely loved it. So I put all that in a letter to him, and I told him how qualified we were. We had been running Smokey Joe's Cafe around the country and had done many tours, and we were good managers. And I stressed that we, but I also stressed how much it meant to me. And I put some jokes, and I remember I wrote in all caps, "I want that money," with exclamation points, which of course is a line from the show. And he called the next day. The phone rang, and there he was. It was really, really...
Richard, Mel Brooks on two.
That's right. That's right. It was, you know, one of the all-time, you know, moments. And he came and interviewed us, and basically he hired us. I mean... We ended up, you know, he ended up putting together producers. He put together the touring entity and Drew Jamson and himself and us. We were the operating arm. We were the general managers and kind of the line producers. Drew Jamson is the theater owner, was involved. And the other producer was Clear Channel or Live Nation or whatever they were called at the time. But it was the largest operator of road touring venues in the country. And that was the partnership, and it was a terrific partnership. It worked really well. Rocco was, you know, wildly enthusiastic about it. Rocco Landisman ran Drew Jamson at the time. And it worked out. But that letter was, you know, really, really important. And it was written out of despair and desperation.
It's the second time you've used the word desperation.
Really?
It seems to work out for you.
I guess it is.
Actually,
the spirit of the producers.
People ask me all the time, like, should I write a letter? And my answer is like, what's it going to hurt? Like,
yes.
Are you not going to get it any more than you've already not gotten it? Like, what? Why not? Give it a shot. So obviously all shows can't be the producers, unfortunately. How do you deal with a show that doesn't work? How do you personally take that?
Well... It never gets easy. It's never easy. Either the ones that are successful creatively and don't recoup are, you know, disappointing. You've failed your investors and it's disappointing, and you feel, why are these other shows being recognized and we're not? It's unfair. This is really a wonderful show.
Do you have an example of one of those shows in your list of many?
No, I don't. There are some Sondheim shows, for example, that don't recoup. Most of Sondheim shows didn't recoup originally. And, you know, they're all time we've worked on. We've done four Sondheim revivals. And, all of them have been like in a dream. You know, I can't believe our good fortune that we were working on these shows and working with him. But not all of them recouped, and you're disappointed. But the shows worked. The ones that you that just fail because they never came together and they never worked are massive disappointments and create heartache as well as guilt for, I would say, quote, failing the creators of it, the writers, and failing the investors in it. Somehow it's always, it's our fault. It's the producer's fault if the show fails. Ultimately, I mean, if we're running the thing, of course we're responsible, but we can't control everything, of course, but we're responsible nonetheless. And some of the big failures that we've had, Leap of Faith, Time and Again, in the 90s, we worked 7 years on Time and Again, and we just never made it work. And it's a wonderful piece of material. It just never came together, and despite the 7 or 8 iterations of it that we tried. Those are heartbreaks. I don't know what to say about it. You know, Leap of Faith, I felt, was way better than it was received. I felt it was, you know, I felt it deserved better. But I recognized it had problems. It had inherent problems with the story. I mean, maybe the answer for that is that we shouldn't have done Leap of Faith. It was about a very unsympathetic person at heart. But it was heartbreaking. So I don't know if that's the best answer to your question, but the ones that you don't, that you fail at are tough.
Well, how do you bounce back?
Well, you just bounce back. I mean, I think it's Manny Eisenberg who always has a reading. Hal Prince, they say, always had a reading the day after the opening. He always had a reading of another. And fortunately, the way we're all set up in business, where we have to do multiple shows, and after all, we're in a business where the business model is that the show will go not bankrupt, but the business will end in a period of time. It's not like, for example, it's one of the reasons we opened 54 Below. We had the idea that we could run a theatrical endeavor that would run for years and years and years, and we wouldn't be concerned about it closing, be that as it may. But what's my point? But the nature of the business is that shows will close. They will go through an infancy and a maturity and prosperity and then an old age, and then they will be gone. And so because of that, if you want to make a living in this business, you have to keep the pipeline full. So the nature of the business mandates that you're always on to the next show. It's absolute requirement, because otherwise you got people to pay. You have to have another show. And so that financial imperative, it has been the key to sanity as well, because how am I going to recover from, any one of them, any one of the really disappointing ones? The answer is I have other children who need to be fed, and I got to deal with them.
Okay, my last question, which is my James Lipton-like question.
Ooh.
I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to your office and says, Richard, I want to thank you for the 60, 75 shows you produced on Broadway and the incredible contributions you made to this industry by granting you one wish. What's the one thing that drives you so crazy about Broadway that makes you mad? I see you in the elevator all the time. You're nice and jovial and everything seems fine. What makes you so mad about this business that would get you banging on the tables and staying up at night that you would ask this genie to wish away?
I don't know. I don't know. It seems sometimes, what would I wish away? Honestly, it sounds like I'm dodging it, but I don't think, I mean, I have quibbles with, you know, I can quibble with the power structure, like producers don't have any, basically, and I can quibble with the secondary markets that make a lot of money and the providers of services who are quasi-parasites. I can quibble with all of that, but I know this sounds like a cop-out, but it isn't. I am genuinely thrilled with the whole thing. I genuinely love it. And, you know, I wonder sometimes, you know, it's been the same, not only, you know, for the 100 years of Broadway, but there was a press agent for gladiator fights. I mean, people have been presenting entertainments to other people for thousands of years, and there have been people. There was somebody worried about the box office, presumably, at the Coliseum. And the system is so filled with history and is so filled with tradition and people's roles that I genuinely love it. And that's while being realistic about the disparities, the unfairness of big aspects of it. There are large aspects that are just unfair, both in the business aspects and creatively too. I mean, the actor pool is ridiculously talented. I mean, and it's just, it's heartbreaking that there aren't enough jobs for everybody given how good they are. You have auditions and it's a joke, actually. What comes through the door, everybody who comes through the door is so gifted and so talented. So there's unfairness on the creative side and there's unfairness on the business side as well. But there's no, maybe what I'm saying is that even the genie couldn't fix it. Maybe that's the note I should leave on. The problems in the theater are so like complicated it would challenge even the genie.
But what I love about your answer is that you love it anyway, despite its dysfunction and all the neuroses the industry has. Well, thank you so much. Thank you. I'm no genie, but thank you for doing the podcast. Thanks all of you for listening. We've had the producer of the producers on today. Pretty good. I'm Ken Davenport. This has been another episode of the Producer's Perspective podcast. We'll see you next time. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget Saturday, September 24th, 2 o'clock. Get your show off the ground. Reserve your spot today. Only 4 spots left. Theproducersperspective.com has all the info.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.